Tuesday, April 22nd. I'm Kevin Grau, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Robert B. Jones for the Indiana University School of Medicine History Project. Dr. Jones, as we get started, perhaps you could share a bit about your educational background and also why you became interested in medicine originally.
Okay. I went to undergraduate school at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, and I was going to be a physicist, and then realized that higher level physics was probably beyond me intellectually, and took a biology course and became interested in medicine as a result of it, and wound up going to medical school in Chapel Hill. During the summer, after my first year of medical school, I did a summer research project with the then chairman of biochemistry there and fell in love with research and decided I might just prefer to be a PhD and do research for the rest of my life, and actually dropped out of medical school in order to do research. Well, this was during Vietnam, and my draft board in Greensboro, North Carolina told me if I didn't get myself back into medical school, they were going to give me a rifle and make an infantryman out of me. So I did go back to medical school. I got some support from the Navy. They said, "You want to do research, son? Fine, sign here and we'll let you do research." And I finished my MD PhD in Chapel Hill, did a year of internship in Seattle in internal medicine, and then went into the Navy for 3 years where I did research in Bethesda, Maryland. After that, I returned to the University of Washington in Seattle, completed my residency in internal medicine, did a fellowship in infectious diseases, and like most other things, there was a certain amount of serendipity in that. It turned out that while I was in the Navy, I had worked on bacterial endotoxin because the Navy was interested in shock, and that was led to a form of shock that was common in the Vietnam War. Mentor that was available to me in infectious diseases in Seattle was interested in sexually transmitted diseases at a time that very few other people were interested in it. And so I spent my fellowship years learning about the organism that causes gonorrhea. When I got ready to leave there, I talked to my mentor and said, "I'm not sure there's much of interest left to do with this particular organism." And he said, "Why don't you go learn how to grow chlamydia?" Ted Kuo at the University of Washington was one of three or four people in the country that was able to grow chlamydia trachomatis. And so I did that. And at the end of my fellowship, went job hunting, wound up coming to Indiana because there was a person here, then the chairman of microbiology, Bill Sawyer, who had the requisite background and skills to potentially be a good mentor for me. And so I came here and I got my first NIH grant, actually in the area of gonorrhea, but I had set up a laboratory for chlamydia, and at that time was one of maybe four or five labs in the country that could grow chlamydia trachomatis. And so that led to a number of I never really went back to gonorrhea, but continued working on chlamydia. One of my ambitions was to emulate my mentor, King Holmes, in Seattle, and to develop a federally funded sexually transmitted diseases research center. And I was able to do that. And actually was then embarked on a fairly standard academic career of research, teaching, and clinical care, spending, like most of the internal medicine department, a fair amount of time at Wishart Hospital for the teaching part of it. Do you want me to go on with this theme, or shall I stop here?
To a little bit, to some of the, one detailed question about when you were in Bethesda, mm-hmm. Was your affiliation at Bethesda with NIH, or was it with another institution?
It was with the Naval Medical Research Institute which was housed there. And my initial assignment, this was really amusing. My commander, the CO, was Captain Richter, and I reported to duty, and he said, "Son, we're interested in shock. You're a biochemist," because my PhD was in biochemistry. "Go do something biochemical with shock." And so I met with the surgeons there who were shocking dogs, and I didn't think that was very interesting. But there was a biochemist there, actually a German national, who was doing work with endotoxin, and that's how I got interested in that.
And was the, because of sort of their physical proximity, was there a lot of overlap between the institutions and sort of communication between NIH and the naval research structures, or were they pretty much siloed apart?
They were pretty much siloed, at least in the areas in which I was working. Mm-hmm. I think there was more communication in transplant immunology and things like that, but in the work I was doing, they were siloed. We jokingly referred to them as the Yellow Berets.
When, now, during what time was that?
This was 71 to 74.
Okay. And if I remember correctly, you had referred to your fellowship and ID as being serendipitous.
Well, particularly the mentor was serendipitous. The person that suggested I might want to apply for a fellowship in infectious disease was one of the many outstanding clinicians at the University of Washington. University of Washington at that time had a really strong infectious disease program. And so I did apply. I was thinking about that or oncology. And when he asked me to apply for infectious disease, I thought, okay, I will, and I was accepted. And then, but he told me, "I don't have any laboratory work for you to do, so why don't you go see King Holmes and see if he doesn't have something." And so that's how my research was sort of channeled into sexually transmitted diseases, which was something my father, who was a Quaker minister, never understood. How his son, it was okay that I became a doctor, it wasn't okay that I chose that particular research area.
And you had mentioned that that Dr. Holmes had established at Washington a federally funded research center.
Yes.
You know, this is now in the early to mid-70s.
Right.
At a time when, you know, the NIH has sort of had its first great wave of expansion.
And the field was really brand new. I mean, King Holmes was one of the three or four pioneers in developing that as a field of medical research, clinical research. So, and it was a period of rapid growth in federal funding.
And at the time, do you remember sort of the scale of his operation, how many researchers were around him at Washington?
I'd say he had five or six faculty level, mm-hmm. and then a number of people under him. But he also was great at knitting collaborations together, and that was one of the things that I think I learned from him, was how to bring people who have interests that are somewhat related together on a common project. He was really good at that.
And you talked about the fact that one of the early challenges, I mean, the sort of great scientific or technical problem you were confronting was how to culture the organism.
Chlamydia.
Right.
Yeah, it's an intracellular parasite and can only be grown in tissue culture. And it's difficult to collect from human specimens, which was what the interest was. Mm-hmm. Was at that point in time was defining the spectrum of disease that was caused by the organism. And so it was difficult to isolate it and grow it. It's almost an art form. Lots happened since then. It's not anymore. In fact, we don't even use tissue culture now. We use other techniques. But
at the time, this was sort of a central problem. And I assume not just in STD research, but in a lot of ID research, that investigators cluster around the organism.
Yes, they do.
And that in many ways, expansion of the field entails being able to replicate those techniques from laboratory to laboratory.
It does, and replicate the interest too. One of the things that King Holmes had was he had a fellowship program, which meant NIH funding to pay stipends for fellows in sexually transmitted diseases. And I think there were, I know there was one other one in the country, there might have been two, but they were relatively few. And so the people that came through his program wound up, many of us wound up going out to other institutions and setting up research programs along those lines at the other institutions. I could, you know, give you a number of names of people. But
when you said that you came to IU, and you mentioned Bill Sawyer.
Yeah.
You could talk a bit more about, I guess, two kinds of things. One is how you made the decision to come here, and two, before coming here, what your perceptions of Indiana University, the School of Medicine, was at that time.
Well, my perception grew out of, when you're looking, you look at the available jobs, and usually those will come through your mentoring. I looked here and someplace else. And the other place I looked had lots of new equipment, lots of laboratory space, all that, but no real collaborators. And when I looked here, I looked first just in the Division of Infectious Diseases, and there was no research, meaningful research going on in the Division of Infectious Diseases at that time. Others would say there was, but I did not think there was. And so I wasn't very interested in coming here. And I went back and I talked to King, and King says, wait a minute, let me see what I can do. And he called up. He knew that Bill Sawyer because of the professional associations in the field. And he called up Bill and asked Bill, told him about me and said, would there be any chance of him getting a joint appointment, one in medicine, which would be where his clinical appointment would be, but also one in microbiology and immunology so he could work with you and with the people you've gathered around you, because he gathered a number of young investigators in things related to sexually transmitted diseases. And Bill said, sure. And so that changed everything, because that gave me a group of people with whom I could work, and somebody who could help me get started in terms of federal grants and things like that. And that's actually the way it worked out.
And at the time...
But my perception of the Infectious Disease Division was that it was not very strong from a research standpoint.
Were there any areas that you looked at, either before you came or as you came here, and said that this is an area where IU is making an impact in research that gave you some degree of hope for where the institution might be headed?
You don't look at it that broadly, at least I didn't, when I was that junior. I was looking at for where my own career could flourish. And I felt like, again, under Bill Sawyer, the microbiology department had a strong sexually transmitted diseases research program. I mean, the people who were there, a couple of them have died by now, but there was a group of about five young people, young faculty members and scientists who were doing some really neat stuff.
When, one question, let me step us back a bit. Do you recall what your first publication was as a researcher?
It was when I was a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the exact title, but it had to do with phosphorylation of histone proteins in regenerating rat liver. It was related to cancer research.
The by the time that you had reached IU, had you started, I assume that you started publishing on the chlamydia research?
Not the chlamydia yet. I had some publications from the time when I was in the Navy on endotoxin and endotoxin shock. And then I had one or two publications on gonorrhea from my fellowship years, as well as some several abstracts. But at the Chlamydia, I hadn't done anything with yet until I got here, other than learn how to grow it and set up a laboratory here.
So when you came, and in terms of setting up the laboratory, this is in 78, is that correct?
Correct.
Nowadays, if you were a researcher who was being cultivated by the university, there would be a formal package sort of, you know, on the table for, you know, trying to convince you that I use where you want to be. Formally or informally, what did the package look like in 1978?
I was offered a package. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went back. I mean, making the connection with Bill Sawyer was one thing, but then I went back to the division chief, his name was Arthur White, of infectious disease, and told him what I needed to come here, which, if I remember right, I know there was a $50,000 piece of equipment that I needed, and there was also ongoing S&E, which I think was about $50,000 or thereabouts. And
do you remember where that lab space was on the campus?
Yeah, it was in Emerson Hall.
Mm-hmm. Was that space primarily for micro at the time, or was it a mixed?
It was for infectious diseases, so within the Department of Medicine. But the medical science building was right across the courtyard, mm-hmm. so I had easy access to the people that I wanted to collaborate with.
And you said earlier that your initial NIH funding, your initial NIH grant was for the gonorrhea research.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was that a grant that was in place when you came, or one?
No, it's one I got after I got here. I used the data that I generated during my fellowship years, plus some more data that I generated here, in order to have enough data to submit an NIH application. And the place I got some help in terms of the writing and so on from Bill Sawyer. But at the same time, I was in the process of setting up this Chlamydia research lab. And the grant was a 3-year grant, and I finished the grant, but I didn't attempt to renew it because by then I was much more heavily involved in Chlamydia and was getting, I'd gotten some funding for Chlamydia research too. But then March of Dimes, for one thing, and then I got some NIH funding for this.
And we had said that you had seen King Holmes' research center at Washington as a model.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a bit more about that experience of sort of trying to replicate that kind of center and establish it on this campus?
Well, the key ingredients that I saw were having access to an appropriate patient population for clinical studies, having a laboratory base, both in terms of basic research and in terms of clinical laboratory, to enable you to study those patients and the questions that would arise out of those patients. And so, that was what he had in Seattle. So one of the first things I tried to do here was to gain a foothold in the County Health Department Sexually Transmitted Diseases Clinic. And I was able to do that. Make a long story short, within a couple years I was able to recruit somebody who'd been trained in Seattle but was in Baltimore to become the director of the Sexually Transmitted Diseases Clinic, and also a faculty member within the ID division. And she's still here, actually. She's the County Health Commissioner now, Virginia Kane. So that was one critical piece, having the research tools to do neat things that other people couldn't do was another piece, and a lot of that came out of the collaboration with the people in microbiology that I was talking about, like being able to make monoclonal antibodies, which was a brand new technique then, to chlamydia. And the third piece was having the clinical laboratory, which I described a little bit earlier, which could grow chlamydia from clinical specimens. And so be able to do clinical epidemiological studies and on patients. So those pieces knitted together gave me sort of a research base. And then creating a sexually transmitted diseases research center, as they were defined at the time by NIH, involved multiple disciplines, multiple investigators, and so we had people doing research on gonorrhea, papillomavirus, chlamydia at that point in time. Those were the main organisms. It later evolved so that other syndromes and even other institutions like the University of Chicago were involved, but at that point it was just IU.
When one of the important relationships that, you know, IU, the School of Medicine, was strengthening throughout the late 60s and the 70s was the close relationship with then Wishart Hospital. In terms of sexually transmitted disease research and moving towards building out the research center, how was your relationship with Wishart? How much of your time was being was their institution?
Most of what I did during that period of time at Wishart was simply what other clinicians did, teach and take care of patients. My research was focused much more on the Bellflower Clinic, which is a separate branch of the Health and Hospital Corporation. There's the Wishart branch, and there's the Health Department branch, and now there's another one. But the Bellflower Clinic was within the Health Department branch. So, frankly, Wishart did not play a large role. In fact, in some cases, later on, it was a competing role because the pathology department, by then chlamydia, identification of people infected with chlamydia had become a profit center, and so pathology at Wishart tried to develop that as their own path. Profit center, and we competed.
So, where at the time, where was the Bellflower Clinic located?
Where it is now, which is right next to Wishart.
And you have a sense of how the clinic operated and what its population was at the time?
I do. I'm trying to think. It was a very typical of a city sexually transmitted diseases clinic. The people who came there were people who, for the most part, were without resources and came because they thought they had something or had acquired something or felt guilty and wanted to know if they'd acquired something. And then people that were referred in because they were contacts to people who did have a sexually transmitted disease. It was run by the county and with a lot of input from people from the Centers for Disease Control.
Compared to sort of...
But the thing that we accomplished by recruiting the director, we got a commitment from the health department and from the... that we could conduct research in the Sexually Transmitted Diseases Research Center. And the reason this was such a key ingredient. Most cities in the country at that point in time, and still, there's little cooperation or collaboration between county health departments and universities. And that inhibits any research in this area because the only good populations, again, at that point in time, for this type of research were people attending these kinds of clinics. So unless you had that, you couldn't do it.
And that goes back to my next question, which was exactly how the dynamic here in Marion County compared to the sort of national norm for the sort of academic and public health collaboration.
Well, the person that I recruited from Baltimore actually came here because she couldn't do the kinds of things she wanted to do at Hopkins that we could do here. Now they can, but at that time they just didn't have a relationship between Johns Hopkins and the Baltimore City or County Health Department.
And this is again Virginia Kane.
Yeah.
And what did you recall about when she arrived here, when you recruited her?
The same year the Colts came. I think it's 85.
when she arrived, about the young sort of time in the early to mid-80s, what were the sort of most significant public, you know, in terms of sexually transmitted diseases, what were the most important sort of public health issues here in the county?
At that time, it was gonorrhea and chlamydia. Chlamydia was just being defined as a significant disease. Gonorrhea had been for some time and was recognized as such. And there was some syphilis here as well. Papillomavirus hadn't really been discovered yet. Well, it had been discovered, but it wasn't appreciated its significance. And herpes, general herpes, was the other one that people paid attention to.
In that same period, I guess what question I'm asking is, at what time did you finally reach the point that the NIH funding for the research center came through? Do you recall in the first cycle?
I think for the STD center, it was 84, 85. And I had other funding before that. And one of the things that's perhaps worth mentioning, one of the things that King Holmes did that a lot of other mentors don't do, is he threw studies my way, drug company studies, which provided the opportunity to generate profits to support the development of a research lab. At that time, you could generate 50% profit off a drug study. So if somebody wanted me to evaluate a drug for treating gonorrhea, a company wanted me to, like Roche or Pfizer, then I could do that with the population I had in the Bellflower Clinic, and at the same time, let's say it was a $100,000 study, spin off $50,000, which I could use to develop my laboratory. And what King would do is somebody would approach him, because he was the national leader in this sort of stuff, and say, we need to place studies in five centers to study this new drug we have. Where would you recommend? And King would send them to people like me and others who had trained in his laboratory. So it gave us the ability to make these things happen.
So it sort of became the funds that sort of primed the pump.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, with those kind of dollars being made available, how did that alter the sort of the requests or demands that you were placing on the medical school in terms of support for the laboratory?
By that time, I was self-supporting in terms of my research. And I wasn't making demands on the medical school. Now, one thing I got from the medical school when I first came, within the first year, was I got a biomedical research grant, which was a starter grant. It's just like they are today. And that helped me get started, too. So that really offset some of the contribution that had been guaranteed by the department.
And in putting the research center together, who were your key collaborators?
In the first round, the first center, it's been a long time, they were from microbiology. They were Randy Rosenthal, Chip Wild, Rich Hawk, and Roman, I think, was in the first one. She was in subsequent ones. And in the infectious disease division, Ken Fife, who I had helped recruit here, actually a couple years after I got here. He had come out of Seattle. He thought he had a job in the public health service. Nixon closed the public health service hospitals. He was suddenly without a job. And so we were able to get him here, and he worked on herpes virus, which is a sexually transmitted disease. So, anyway, Ken Fife. At the first round, those were the key people.
And,
that's enough.
When you,
the other thing the university had, or the department had, which was very helpful, was a biostatistics group, and we used them fairly extensively. Sorry.
And the biostatistics group was located where? When? Do you remember what their institutional home was?
It was Department of Medicine. I don't remember where their offices were then.
As the research center develops, does this change the way in which IU is training people in ID? Do you start to see more students who are getting trained in ID? Are there ID fellowships at the time? What's sort of on the teaching side? What does the picture look like?
Well, it was the primary research opportunity within the Division of Infectious Diseases. So if somebody, for those people who were fellows in infectious diseases and receiving the clinical training, their research opportunity was almost entirely in one aspect or another of sexually transmitted diseases. So in that sense, it did change things. There weren't many fellows before this, though. In ID. Now, if you go back a couple years before I came here, there had been somebody here who was funded and did have fellows, but he left and went to San Francisco.
So. And when in the mid 1980s, obviously certainly the politics around sexually transmitted disease research in the United States, it's altered with the emergence of AIDS as a medical and a cultural phenomenon.
AIDS was late to get to the Midwest. Mm-hmm. I mean, we watched it develop on the coasts. Mm-hmm. And of course, those of us in infectious diseases, there was no AIDS when we went into it. We never anticipated having large outpatient business because mm-hmm. we were a hospital-based specialty. We saw people with surgical wound infections and endocarditis and things like that. So, but we had the luxury of being able to watch it develop on the coast before it got to Indiana. When it got to Indiana, initially it was primarily among gay men. Now the politically correct term is men who have sex with men. And so we didn't enter into that right away, and it never was, because of the way the federal funding mechanisms went, it never was a part of the Sexually Transmitted Diseases Research Center, even though it is a sexually transmitted disease. We did get an AIDS clinical trials grant, and I was the PI on that. That was in the late 80s, I think. I'd have to go back and look as to exactly when it was. It wasn't something I was terribly interested in, and actually after one cycle I passed it over to somebody else to be the PI on it.
Having watched, though, in your own research, coming into a field in chlamydia research where the organisms just really become the focus of attention, the sort of boundaries of the disease definition aren't yet really set. But in many ways, you have an organism, mm-hmm. and you're sort of tracing out its pathological effects of it and understanding it better. And watching a sort of an entire sort of research program develop from the organism. And now you have in the 80s, AIDS, where you have a cluster of symptoms and you have a syndrome and you're in search of the disease. From your perspective, are there any things that you came to learn from sort of watching these two different aspects of the field play out, where you have an organism and you're sort of exploring the bounds of the organism versus having the sort of clinical syndrome and watching the field walk back to identifying the organism?
Let me take chlamydia first. Chlamydia was a nice organism to work with because one of the things that we established fairly early on, not just here but other places across the country, was that it's a very prevalent disease. There were a lot of people that had it, and a lot of them were sort of nice people. They were upper middle class college students. and the prevalence among college women was around 20%. Now, that's the kind of thing that you can take to Congress, because, I mean, what chlamydia causes infertility in women. That's the primary morbidity associated with it. So, all these congressmen and women want grandchildren, okay? So, and it's not a dirty disease in the way that many other sexually transmitted diseases were viewed. Now, in contrast, HIV came onto the scene as a disease among gays. And there was substantially more homophobia then than there is now. And so initially it was hard to get people interested in it or to get people to want to work on it. That changed as the magnitude of the disease began to be realized. But so, I mean, it was one of, here in Indianapolis, most of the HIV early on was in gay men. And it was a real interesting experience for those of us who were working in the field some to go to meetings of gay men and try to learn enough about their lifestyle to learn how we could be effective in helping them by intervening. I think the question you were asking, though, was, you know, people would present with things that we would think might be HIV, or that we were beginning to learn were syndromes associated with it, and then we'd work backwards to find out if they were infected with HIV. Is that what you were asking?
Well, I think it's more a general sort of research question about having a process where you sort of, you know, have a well-defined organism, as you did with chlamydia, and are sort of working with that versus having a new disease, an emergent disease, where you have the sort of clinical picture of these syndromes associated with it, but don't have the organism yet, and whether or not that, those two different trajectories, how that shapes the way research develops, the way people, what kinds of people sort of enter the field, and sort of the case, you know, the sort of how does, you know, does it affect the way that research around the disease gets institutionalized in different ways?
Well, it does. I'm thinking of a conference, an NIH conference that I went to. And I was there because of my sexually transmitted diseases background, but this was before people knew, had identified the AIDS virus or HIV, and didn't know what was causing it. There were all kinds of strange theories floating around as to what might be causing it, the immunosuppressive effect of semen, things like that. And it was a very eclectic bunch of people. They were on this conference, and there's some funny stories associated with that. But I think that here, the interest in HIV came from the clinical side, because we were starting to see patients at Wishart particularly, and also at University Hospital who had HIV, and we didn't have very much to offer them. And one of the opportunities was this clinical trials program that NIH sponsored, where if you were able to be a participant in it, then not only did you get a fair amount of money, which you could use to hire nurses and things like that, but you then had something that you could offer people, whether it was beneficial or not. At least it made you feel better to be able to say, well, no, we don't have anything that we know will work here, but we do have these experimental drugs, and we'd like to give you the opportunity to participate in a clinical trial. Again, I'm not sure if that's getting at your question or not.
It's certainly getting to sort of your experience of the period and how it differed. In the mid to late 80s, and the research centers established, what did you sort of see, now that you've got the research centers established, and as you said, this was the sort of model that you had, for you professionally, what did you see as sort of the next challenge or the next opportunity?
Well, my research goal had been, aside from creating structures that would facilitate it, had been to develop a vaccine for chlamydia. My goal and a lot of, and the goal of a lot of other people in the country who were working on the organism, and that was the direction in which we were focused, was trying to identify protein candidates for a vaccine, and to understand, as part of that, to understand the manner in which the organism created disease, and why some people could be infected with it and self-cured, and other people, and nothing happened, and other women would be infected with it and would develop silent tubal disease that would leave them infertile. So those were the kinds of things we were trying to do from a research standpoint. I'll have to admit that in the mid-90s, my interest shifted away from, to some extent, the laboratory research that I had been doing. And part of it was because we developed good diagnostic tests for chlamydia. We had good antibiotics to treat it with. We didn't have a vaccine, but it didn't look like we were going to get one at that point. And rather than, this is a different track now. By then I was division chief in infectious diseases. And that came about shortly after I got the AIDS Clinical Trials grant, that the person who had been division chief when I came here stepped down from the administrative role and just did clinical work, and I took over as division chief. But I lost my train of thought.
You're talking about the shift in your interest.
Yeah. The chairman of medicine, who's our current dean, suggested that a couple of us who were division chiefs go take a course in for physician leaders at Wharton. Mm-hmm. And I did that, and it was a week course. And I got really interested in some of the stuff I heard there. And then this was about the time that Clarion was being formed, and there was a lot of discussion going on, and there was also a lot of interest in optimizing the efficiency of our clinical operation within the Department of Medicine. And so I took a position, was offered and took a position as associate chief for, associate department chief for clinical affairs. Mm-hmm. And so was kind of shifting out of the research mm-hmm. arena.
And so this is associate chief of clinical affairs in the Department of Medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you think, as I looked at some of your publications and your professional trajectory, do you think that having worked in ID gave you a particularly sort of close connection between sort of bench research and clinical experience or interest in sort of the clinical impact of more basic research?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that, do you think that that's, would you say that's a common pattern for people in ID, or would you say it's more sort of,
I think most people who go into specialties like infectious diseases in internal medicine go into it because of a research interest,
mm-hmm.
because there is opportunity to tie what you're doing in the laboratory to what you're seeing at the bedside or in the clinic, more so than perhaps some others.
Mm-hmm. And during this period, leading up to when you moved to focus more to clinical affairs, how did the relationship between the medical school and the research center and health and hospital evolve during the 80s and 90s? Did it remain as strong as it had started out as?
Yeah, it did because, with health and hospital it did because Virginia King went on from being the director of the Bellflower Clinic to becoming the county health commissioner. So we were, and She was firmly committed to a strong research program in the Bellflower Clinic. So that tie has remained until now. I think the Department of Medicine has always, I'm not sure, I forget the other piece of the question. The Department of Medicine was the major research department within school medicine in the sense of volume of research dollars, and emphasis on research.
When you, you talked about making the shift into clinical affairs just as the time that hospital consolidation, the creation of Clarion Health Partners was occurring. Before the Clarion proposal was formally announced, when you looked out across the campus and looked at the clinical structure, what was your sense of the situation in terms of, this medical center and its clinical operations in the sort of context of, hospital consolidation and proposals for healthcare reform and, that sort of...
Let me back up and try, and then I'll try to come back at that. The thing that happened as a result of the Horton experience was I suddenly realized, and there was a whole new world out there that I'd never seen before. This had to do with the business of medicine and things like negotiation and so on.